The deep sea is the most extensive habitat on our planet and it supports high biodiversity. And scientists believe that as many as 10 million species inhabited the deep sea, an ecosystem that may be as rich as the tropical rainforest. The majority of species are yet to be discovered.
That's Anja Hazenkamp, a Dutch member of the European Parliament on January 17th. Protesting the Norwegian Parliament's first-in-the-world decision to open its seabed to exploration and mining.
The deep sea is also critical for other environmental services, such as long-term carbon sequestration. This kind of activity could quite literally start a global race to the bottom, a race to mine the ocean floor. The position of the EU is clear. The precautionary principle must be applied, and we need an international moratorium on deep seabed mining. We need to send a clear message to the Norwegian Parliament to withdraw the decision.
While the Norwegian Parliament, the Storting, approved the plan on January 9th with an 80% majority, the EU's Parliament, as you can hear, isn't as enamored with it. Neither are Norway's own Environment Agency and the Institute for Marine Research, which both said the country doesn't know nearly enough about the environment in the area to take this step. As far as the EU goes, even though Norway isn't an EU member, a vote by the EU's parliament to condemn Norway's decision sends a strong message. I'm Nancy Basilchuk, and you're listening to 63 Degrees North, an original podcast from NTNU, the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. Today, I'm going to take a closer look at Norway's landmark decision to open an area the size of Italy, most of it in the Arctic, to exploration and mining. I'll be talking to experts from all sides of this debate, to find out why some believe it to be a responsible move and the only way forward if we're going to transition away from fossil fuels, and others who think it's a terrible idea.
The Challenger expedition is often thought of as the birth of modern oceanography. And it was also they who first discovered the manganese nodules. They did a haul to the west of the Canary Islands in February 1873, where they first got a small piece of what turned out to be a manganese nodule.
That's right. We've known about seabed minerals for more than a century. The story starts with the British Challenger expedition, which circumnavigated the globe from 1873 to 1876. And that's Mats Ingolstad, a professor at NTNU's Department of Modern History and Society. In addition to his research on the history and development of strategic minerals, he also heads an interdisciplinary program called Triple Deep, which is looking at the many cross-cutting issues surrounding deep-sea mining. Those manganese nodules that the British Challenger expedition found on the seafloor are not the kinds of minerals that are found in the area that Norway has opened to mining. But the discovery awoke the collective consciousness that there could be something more than fish of value in the seas.
It really opened up a new idea of the deep seabed as a place where you could find vast mineral riches.
And this is in the 1870s.
Yeah. And the thing is that for most of human history, the deep seas have been sort of off limits and they haven't really been of interest. So when ships sailed, they weren't interested in how deep the ocean was. They were interested in knowing how shallow it was so they could avoid running aground, or they could locate fisheries that were quite rich on shallow areas. So they seldom carried more than 100 or 200 fathoms of sounding line.
For Norway, the real shift began in 2008 when a multinational expedition led by a geologist from the University of Bergen discovered a series of hydrothermal vents in the Arctic. These were much farther north than other similar seafloor deposits. The researchers had a remotely operated vehicle and found these vents, or black smokers, in water that was more than 2,000 meters deep. They called the area Loki's Castle because the vents took the form of chimneys, like fantastical lumpy castles built by kids. A University of Bergen press release from that time said the name was chosen with reference to the ancient Norse god of trickery, Loki, which the researchers thought was an appropriate name for a field that was so difficult to locate. The area that the Norwegian government has opened to seabed exploration and mining covers part of the Arctic mid-ocean ridge. Loki's Castle is a part of that ridge, but the government's plan excludes it and other active hydrothermal vents from mining because active vents are thought to be more biologically rich and important. The key here is that these underwater vents spew mineral-rich water out into the ocean, where the minerals can precipitate and collect around the vents. Until this discovery, researchers didn't think these kinds of deposits were found off Norway. But they are.
This area is extremely interesting because it's an active tectonic area where you have a spreading ridge, making the Greenlandic side and the Norwegian side to move apart from each other. Related to this spreading ridge, you have volcanic activity, so you form new oceanic crust. And with that, you also have hydrothermal, so hot fluids that circulates in the oceanic crust, comes up through what we know as these black chimneys or hydrothermal chimneys. And precipitation of different minerals, among them copper-rich, zinc-rich minerals. This precipitation happens on the seafloor, but also inside the crust where you have more rich areas.
That's Kurt Osli, a professor of process mineralogy at NTNU's Department of Geoscience and Petroleum. Those first deposits he described are called seafloor massive sulfide deposits, which contain copper and zinc.
You also have seamounts, which are covered, some of them are covered with a thin layer of what we call cobalt-rich manganese crust. This crust that can be typically up to 8 centimeters thick on the original rock. It contains metals like manganese, copper, nickel, and cobalt, of course. And then potentially also some rare earth minerals or metals.
When researchers have explored these hydrothermal vents, they found much more than this treasure trove of minerals. They began to find all kinds of weird creatures living around them that no one had ever seen before. A whole ecosystem evolved to survive in the deep under incredible water pressure and right next to waters that are so hot they can melt plastic.
There are two issues that are raised immediately. One is that this is a vast treasure of mineral riches.
Mats Ingolstad.
And also this is a biological hotspot potentially for lots of unknown species.
That's more or less where things still stand today. On the one hand, the potential for great wealth, new jobs, especially for Norway's oil and gas industry, which has expertise working offshore. And on the other, this unknown kingdom of organisms that we know almost nothing about. But before we talk about the biological hotspots, let's dive a little more deeply into what the Norwegian Parliament actually did when it acted on January 9th.
Norway actually granted the start of deep sea mining on a part of the Norwegian exclusive economic zone, about 280,000 square kilometers.
My name is Egil Kjåland, and I'm an associate professor at the Department of Geoscience and Petroleum. And then I have another title, which is Secretary General of the Norwegian Forum for Marine Minerals. So the Norwegian Parliament opened up the process after about 4 years of public hearings and reporting. There was a 4/5 majority of the Norwegian Parliament for opening up this sector or this area.
Needless to say, a secretary general of the Norwegian Forum for Marine Minerals, Egil thinks the government's decision is a good idea.
If you look at the reason for the parliament to do this, that is to obtain security for metals and minerals. That is the main objective. And professionally, we are moving into this energy transition with the need of metals for all these new energy sources like windmills and solar panels, and we need to make batteries and all that stuff. And if you look at the demand for materials to drive this energy transition, you need to secure those ingredients inside those things. And right now, Europe has almost nothing. I think we're talking about maybe 2-3% of all the materials that we have for mining in Europe. It used to be 50, 60, 70% just 100 years ago.
Kurt Osley agrees about the need for new metal mineral resources, but his concerns about the government's approach.
I think that opening for exploration in the extended Norwegian continental shelf is important, because we know there are potential for mineral resources down there. So I think that part of the decision is good. And when the government says that, okay, if the commercial companies, they will be given the responsibility to collect data about the potential resources, the government will have the responsibility for collecting data about the environment, biology, and all the other things that you need to know before you make decisions for potential mining. If that comes together, that's very good. What I personally or professionally think can be a bit difficult is that they have opened for mining. So the license is a mining license.
Kurt says people who look at the worst case scenario assume that the government will immediately allow companies that have been given licenses to mine once they finish their exploration, but that's not correct.
The actual license gives you the exclusive rights to an area to explore for potential mineral resources, and then if the company finds something that shows that this can be actually be mined with a profit, then they have to do a new environmental impact assessment for this area, provide a mining plan and an application to the Storting, and then the Storting has to decide if this is okay or not.
Biologists are particularly concerned about how little we know about this giant area and its strange, otherworldly biology.
The general concern is that the knowledge we have about these areas is so tiny. Considering the area, the size, it's almost as big as mainland Norway. It's huge. 280,000 square kilometers approximately, and the mainland Norway is 330. So it's huge, it's massive. My name is Torkil Bakken, associate professor at NTNU University Museum. I'm a marine biologist and have been working on biological diversity.
I should note that Torkil recently co-authored a paper about the creatures found around Loki's castle, Ventfjord. At least 10 of the species he and his colleagues found have yet to be named.
We have been down at the seabed very, very few times. And when we have been there, or someone have been there, the areas that have been studied or sampled, it's only a few square meters at a time. And that's pinpoints within this huge area. So we have very little and very fragmented knowledge.
Torkel says the challenge with seabed mining, especially the kind that would be done in Norwegian waters, is that it is destructive. Mining would involve dredging up or scraping these layers of minerals off the seabed. So that habitat disappears. But there's also the issue of fine sediments that will be kicked up by the mining. And sound. How noisy will it be, both during exploration and mining itself? We know that whales, for example, are vulnerable to underwater noise. How will this affect them? And how will this affect ocean bottom currents, about which we know very, very little?
What happens when there's an impact? Well, so you see it from the bottom trawling as well, the sediment plumes. So they bury the life that lives on the bottom or in the seabed, in the sediment, in that area. So that's a concern. That's why I would say that we can't do deep sea mining sustainably, in the biological meaning of sustainability, because it's totally destruction of that exact area that you're mining or trawling, for that matter, where the impact is.
So why do this at all? Egil Choland, who we heard from earlier, argues that if we want to make the transition to a greener economy, we need seabed minerals to build more electric cars, build windmills, and improve transmission grids. And he says we can't recycle our way out of this problem.
Copper is a material that we can recycle quite easily. Aluminium, of course, we know that. But when it comes to demand for the energy transition, let's say copper, we need of the order of 5 to 6 times more copper production than we have today. So we cannot recycle what we have. We cannot take out the copper wires in the walls to recycle it. It's not logical. It doesn't make sense. In order to get enough material, you need to have an additional source.
So where do we get these minerals?
Well, you can, of course, increase production onshore, terrestrial mining. But that has also an impact, an environmental impact. So to take an example of nickel. Nickel, the biggest producer is Indonesia. Indonesia, they have one of the biggest rainforests in the world. So when you produce, take a new nickel mine in Indonesia, you also disturb environment. So it's kind of a problematic area. You would like an energy transition. We all like that. We would like the materials, and we cannot get enough by recycling alone. We need to do something. And by just sitting there and hoping that it comes from somewhere, that is, to me, a very dangerous approach.
I will note here that not everyone agrees that recycling can't be a big part of the solution. The European Academy's Science Advisory Council published an assessment of deep sea mining with an eye to future metals demand and environmental impacts in June 2023. In sum, they concluded that for Europe anyway, recycling could meet as much as 40 to 77% of the region's clean energy metals needs by 2050. In fairness, however, that number has been disputed by some. Regardless of the actual numbers, the Council has called for a moratorium on deep-sea mining because its environmental impacts are so poorly understood. But Egil makes two other arguments. The first is the potential value of minerals and metals in the zone that Norway has opened for exploration and mining. This estimate comes from the former Norwegian Petroleum Directorate, which has now been renamed the Norwegian Offshore Directorate.
They have an estimate which is based on samples they have done over the last 4, 5, 6 years. And the resource estimate they have is enormous.
And how much money are we talking about?
I calculated on back of the envelope without taking in the rare earth elements. It's $1.5 trillion.
Yep, that's a lot of cash. But Mats Ingolstad, who's head of the interdisciplinary deep sea mining project, Triple Deep, has a different take on the estimates. He says the government white paper that formed the basis of the Storting's decision is
very enthusiastic about the possibilities, pointing to assessments suggesting the presence of large mineral riches. But the fact of the matter is that we know very little about these potential deposits. So you could not maybe even classify them as resources in what we would think about in layman's terms, at least, as resources, because you don't have the data to describe them or the extent of them scientifically. So it's a huge gamble for rather uncertain gains.
The second argument Egil makes is that Norway can show the way to do this responsibly.
If you look at the oil and gas industry, I mean, you cannot spill a drop of chemicals, unwanted chemicals, into water. There will be, it will be penalized heavily. And you have to just be very careful doing the oil and gas business. So by using this same kind of technology and attitude towards this new fledgling industry, then it means that Norway will be able to maybe point towards how to do this for other countries that will be down the line. I think we could be a role model for this.
Torkild, our biologist, acknowledges that Norway has been careful to monitor its petroleum sites.
If there are areas that are well known, assessed, we know that we can monitor the impact along the way. We see that in petroleum sites off the coast now, for example. And then there's has been a monitoring system for decades. So that you can say that, are there changes going on or not? But then it's well-known areas, and you know what you have. And maybe then you can say, okay, this is a risk, or we do harm. The harm is measurable. We know what the harm is, and we know what the impact is. Can we take that risk? So if you have the knowledge you need, then you can do a qualified decision. But in this area, we don't know. We haven't been there.
While acknowledging that society needs minerals, Torkild points out that there's a big difference between the Norwegian continental shelf, where Norway's oil installations are located, and the deep sea.
We know that we need mineral, so there's a real dilemma. If we're going into a pristine, completely unknown area, what do we know what the impact will be and what we will destroy? We risk losing species that we didn't know we had, species that are still unknown to us. That's one thing. There's also their habitats and parts of the ecosystems. Until we know the range, the size of these areas, we need more knowledge. Simply.
Egil sees other risks, but not the kind you might think.
Well, the risk is that there is not enough materials down there to make any business.
Kurt Osley, our geologist, agrees not enough is known to mine, but he also points out that any mining proposal can take years or even decades for the journey from discovering a viable mineral deposit to actually mining it.
We know from experience, not only in Norway, but at least most of the Western world, that when you find a potential mineral deposit, it takes at least 20 years before that deposit can be mined. It includes many years of work and investments to explore and develop the deposit. Then you have to start applying for permits to do the mining.
Among those are environmental impact statements.
And then you can, in the end, apply and have a license to operate and mine the deposit. This will take years. We know today what we need for the current technology to be viable in the future. We need copper, we need cobalt, we need nickel, all these things. Know what technology will bring in 5 years, 10 years. But if we don't make sure to know where we can find what we need today, it will take even longer time to secure these resources. So we need to work on what we need, define resources, and then start mining if we need them. Doesn't matter if it's onshore or offshore.
I'm going to give the last word to Mats, our historian. The Triple Deep researchers worked together on an opinion piece after the Norwegian government made its decision, saying that we don't know enough. Mats explains.
There's not an apparent will to recognize the limits of what we know, and of what the potential side effects might be, and also that the actual gains from this might turn out to be rather limited. So let's say the technological demand for minerals is not as great, or it's not for the specific minerals that are most accessible in the Norwich area, then you've made quite a gamble and invested a lot of time, a lot of resources, a lot of prestige into something that's ultimately not worthwhile or helpful in driving the transition. So it's highlighting the uncertainty, that's what was our ambition. And from the political signals that we see from the debate in Parliament, they've taken some of this to heart.
There remains, however, an additional problem that the Triple Deep Group identified. It involves something called ecosystem services. This is a fancy way of saying that all the things that are provided by the Earth's ecosystems, from wetlands that protect coastlines from wave erosion or bees that willingly pollinate our food crops, we don't pay for those, so we don't put a monetary value on them. For something like deep sea mining, it can be hard to calculate the financial losses we incur if we alter the ecosystem there, even though in the end it may be critical to our survival.
How can you calculate the value of the ecosystem services? Because this is also, as the biologists like to point out, the production of plankton in sea is really crucial for the production of oxygen. If you disturb the oceanic currents or even conditions in these areas, you could have very substantial knock-on effects through the food webs, but we don't know what they are because we don't know what the food webs look like. So we concluded that if you insist that these minerals can be Norway's contribution to the deep transition away from fossil fuels, and also that it's phenomenal riches that will amount to thousands of jobs and billions of income, then you should at least invest in having the necessary research done to map in geological and biological terms what are the conditions in the deep sea in this territory.
I'm Nancy Basilchuk, and you've been listening to 63 Degrees North, an original podcast from NTNU, the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. My guests on today's show are Mats Ingolstad, Kurt Olsli, Egil Choland, and Torkil Bakken. You can read more about Norway's proposal and find links to some of the documents we've talked about here in the show notes. And if you're curious like me about the history of deep sea mining and want to hear some cool stuff that I couldn't fit into today's show, including, yes, a CIA plot and Howard Hughes, watch your feed. I'm working on a little podcast extra on exactly that. Shout out to Per Jinge for his help. Editing, sound design, and production by me, Nancy Basilchuk. Thanks for listening.